This is David Duke, broadcasting to the world on Web Radio. This is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent, wherever they may live upon the earth. Good to be with you. Again, lots of controversy all over the place. I wanted to take a little bit different tactic today. I wanted to talk about something a little bit, I think, more germane to the issue of the Jewish problem as compared to the Jewish leadership and the average Jewish person in the street that you might know, or the average Jewish person that simply is involved in some sort of community activity or business or in the medical profession or whatever. A lot of people constantly say, in fact, what I'll do is I'll go to a question and by a comment by Spiro, I'm not quite sure how we should pronounce that name, and this is what he asked on the Stormfront Town Hall section. And by the way, those of you who are catching the program through davidduke.com, Town Hall offers a place where you can ask questions and make comments while I do the broadcast online live. And I'll try to get to those comments and share those comments with the audience at large. So it's a great opportunity. It's an interactive program. And we've had some technical difficulties over the last few, last couple of months, but we seem to have worked those out pretty well. And I certainly want to go back to more of an interactive type of program as we go along. And you can certainly post your questions. In fact, you can write to me at davidduke.com, and we have an email address there. That email address changes occasionally, so the best thing to do is go into the email address or to the Contact David Duke button on the davidduke.com page, hit it, and you'll get the latest address. We're still using right now info44@davidduke.com. That's info44@davidduke.com, and it's probably the best address to use right now to reach me. But I'm not quite sure how long that address is going to be good, because we do get spam and things like that. But it's good to know that we can change those addresses, because obviously there are people out there who would like to stop our operation and give us a lot of harassment. We've had some problem recently with the telephone. We've had literally hundreds of messages tying up our answering machines and tying up our phones at the office. Eventually the staff just has to turn them off. They can't do much more. It's against the law, and hopefully those people will be prosecuted. I'm not going to hold my breath, but it's certainly against federal law now to harass people by telephone, but that happens. It seems like every step along the way we have to struggle. We have to really fight for our basic rights, even our rights to express ourselves in our society. I remember even in the campaigns I had for the United States Senate and for the governorship of Louisiana, so many times we reserved hotel rooms, and then there were threats and other problems and pressure, and at the last minute the hotel rooms were canceled, and we just had a lot of difficulty, and it seemed like we had to, often it was very difficult to find a place because of the fact that we were controversial, even though we had thousands of people wanting to come out to the rallies and meetings, and in fact tens of thousands in some cases. We still had a problem actually finding a venue to actually express ourselves. And this is true among many movement groups right now. I mean, it's one thing to have freedom of speech, but you really can't necessarily reach that many people on a street corner. You need a meeting hall. And when we have special interest groups that can pressure and stop this kind of a meeting from taking place, it's a very, very dangerous situation. And I can give you many examples of that happening. So we fight for our freedoms every day. But anyway, so you can definitely write me at davidduke.com. And the address right now is info44@davidduke.com. And that's my little bell, meaning I'm starting to get some emails right now. So apparently a few people are listening, and we're getting some response already. Well, let me go immediately to the Stormfront post that I'm mentioning from Spyro. He says, Dr. Duke, first of all, great job with Scarborough, even though in typical media fashion you were, again, somewhat censored. I agree that the true Jewish supremacists make up only a small percentage of Jews, but are in positions of power. Of the remaining non-supremacist Jews, it's my experience that most have liberal thoughts and agendas. Yet I have seen a Jewish person agree with literature about the IQ theories and revisionism. My question is, do you know of any Jews that agree that we of European stock are entitled to white nationalism? Well, I must say, my friend, it's a rare bird. I have found that, for instance, at the Amrin Convention, there was a few Jews there who obviously think that we're entitled to white nationalism or European nationalism. But ironically, they don't think necessarily that we're entitled to European, or many of them don't think that we're entitled to European white nationalism if we dare to put the interests of European non-Jews over, say, the interest of Israel or the interests of the Jewish community in the United States of America. And that's kind of an interesting phenomenon. Now, that's not true of everyone, but I've seen that phenomena quite a bit. Yes, it's okay. You can stand up for the white race. You can stand up for European heritage. That happens. Again, it's a small, small percentage of Jews that actually do that vocally. But there's very few of them that acknowledge that we have a right to stand up for our heritage and put our heritage in first in our interest as a great majority of the people of the United States of America, the non-Jewish European majority, just as they, Jewish people, continually fight for their interests and their values, whatever they may be. And certainly the Jewish community as a whole is very supportive of the Jewish agenda. Now, again, there's a great deal of divergence among the Jewish community. There are Jews, for instance, who are very strongly anti-war in terms of the Iraq war. There's Jews who are very very much opposed to the policy of the United States in terms of Israel, who object to billions of dollars of American tax money to support the Israeli state, and the fact that the America today and the Jewish community radicals support the Likud party. They believe that the policies that Israel pursue in both Israel proper and the Middle East and the occupied territories and the rest are policies that are going to truly damage the Israeli people, the Jewish people. They're going to result in terrorism. It's going to result in them becoming a pariah to the world. I think that Israel is becoming a pariah to the world because of their incredible criminal behavior. And there are certainly Jews out there who are speaking up against that. A perfect example I know of is Norman Finkelstein. I also noticed that Noam Chomsky has spoken out quite often about the terrible repression of the Palestinian people and some of the very criminal behaviors of Israel. I noticed, though, that Chomsky recently came out and he really undercut the paper of Walton Mearsheimer. Chomsky's been very liberal about Israel, so to speak. I guess a liberal in the fact that he's opposed the policies of Israel in terms of the Palestinians. But suddenly, and it came to the paper of Walton Mearsheimer, he said, oh no, this lobby doesn't exist. He kind of defined it in the old Marxist terms. Oh yeah, it's just this military industrial complex. It's some sort of it's a strategy. It's an oil company, oil executive strategy. This whole Mideast policy, the Iraq war. We just want to go in. The oil companies were behind it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you something. The oil companies were not behind this war. In fact, every bit of data that's offered shows that most of the executives of the oil companies, at least the non-Jewish ones and the non-pro-Israel ones, most of them, in fact, were opposed to the war. In fact, oil companies, and generally speaking, I know many oil men in my life. My dad worked for Shell Oil for 29 years. In fact, I went to kindergarten in Holland because we were over there, and he's an engineer. He worked over with Shell, and he's known many leading oil people, and he also started his own oil business after he left Shell. And he knows many people in the oil industry across the board. And I can tell you that the general feeling of the oil industry and oil executives, and this is not all, certainly, but the general feeling was that our Mideast policy was hurting their opportunities in the Middle East. Of course, these Arab countries and other areas, Muslim countries, were very upset about American policies in terms of Israel and the Palestinians and what happened with Israel's invasion of Lebanon and the Israel's attack, of course, on Iraq and so many other aspects of the Israeli problem, that many of these countries offered the leases and often the developing of the oil, whatever they could find the expertise available, away from American business interests. There's no evidence at all. In fact, there's been some very good papers and some very good academic studies of this. There's no evidence at all that the oil lobby was involved in this conflict. Now, you might say, and there's certainly a good arguable point, that certain people in the defense industries, Halliburton, of which the president owns some money, and some of the defense industries obviously have a lot to gain and profit from a war, and they would certainly work for a war. But ladies and gentlemen, their lobbying ability is very, very tiny compared to what we call the Jewish lobby or the Israeli lobby. I guess politely it's called the Israeli lobby, but it's really a Jewish lobby. And in terms of leadership of this lobby, you have, of course, on the upper level, you've got the AIPAC organization, and there's a number of other groups too, and that's the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, and they dole out hundreds of millions of dollars to both candidates and sitting congressmen. And more importantly than that, they can literally, through their network of influence, they can hurt individual candidates. For instance, if you're a Republican candidate for Congress, and there's other Republican candidates, and you have supporters in the Republican hierarchy in a state, say Louisiana, and one of the Republican candidates is more even-handed on Israel, well, obviously they can use their own pressure of those people who've been getting their money for so long to support the congressional candidate, the Republican candidate who's, you know, 100% behind Israel and the continuation of the billions of dollars of aid and who will turn a blind eye to Israel's terrorism against the United States. I know that's shocking for new people who are hearing this program for the first time to hear, but it's true. Israel has committed terrorism against the United States in addition to the spying, the terribly damaging spying of Jonathan Pollard, which has literally led to the death of American operatives and agents during the Cold War. But ladies and gentlemen, the facts, you know, are there that the Israeli lobby works, and also they have a tremendous network in terms of the media. And I think everybody knows that the Jewish people are extremely overrepresented in the broadcast media of America and the print media. The leading newspaper, the avant-garde paper of America, is the New York Times. Another very powerful newspaper, of course, is the Washington Post. Both of those are controlled by long-time old Jewish families. The Washington Post was bought by Eugene Meyer back in the 1930s. In fact, the Jewish community literally drove the old McCormick paper from which this came into bankruptcy, or practical bankruptcy, because the Jewish advertisers, the dry goods stores, and you go into any city. I remember New Orleans growing up as a boy, it seemed like every department store had the Jewish interest. The Sears and Roebuck, of course, was Edith Stern. We had Godshaw's, which is like a French Jewish firm. We had Gus Myers. We had Gold Rings. I mean, I could go on and on. Their influence was great. And we had one paper in my city. I mean, it was controlled by the Newhouse family, another very rabidly pro-Israel Jewish extremist family out of New York and New Jersey. And they controlled everything that the local people in my city, the city of New Orleans, would see in their local papers. They bought this paper in the early 60s, and before that time, the Picayune was relatively a conservative paper. And it changed very dramatically after the purchase of the paper by the Newhouse family. And the people in New Orleans jokingly call it the Jewhouse family. But so you've got AIPAC, and they have a tremendous influence. Plus, they know so many very, very rich Jews who literally are able, outside of the PAC, to contribute tremendous amounts of money to candidates who favor Israel and to candidates who oppose candidates who are trying to have a more even-handed position in regard to Israel. Now, the Washington Post, in a recent article, and it's very high for the Democrats, too, the Washington Post, in a recent article, and I'm going to, in fact, cite that in one of my new papers, talked about the fact that 50% of the presidential contributions for the Democratic Party, 50% were coming from Jewish sources. Now, that's a huge amount of support, and I've read that it's that high among Republicans as well these days, but that was in a Wall Street Journal. I read a few years ago, but I've not been able to track that down again. I've got to find a copy or check my files when I get back home. But that's a tremendous amount of money, certainly enough money to tip any election. When I ran for the House of Representatives in Louisiana, when I ran for the U.S. Senate governor, I mean, tens of millions of dollars Jewish money came into the state to prevent what they saw as a very radical opponent of Israel from going to the United States Senate. They could not afford to have one man in the Senate talk about this issue. And very few senators would even dare to talk about it. In fact, they usually talk about it later when they're nearing retirement, or if they do talk about it, they get retired in the next election. We had, for instance, in Arkansas, a very famous Senator William Fulbright, who was, of course, the Fulbright Scholar. Scholars are named after him. And he was, quite liberal in some ways. He was pretty much against the Vietnam War. He started out for it, and then he realized the Vietnam War was not being fought to win, and he saw a lot of misconduct, he thought, on the part of the United States government, and he went up opposed to it, and he turned out later to be kind of right, at least affected by the media. And he was a darling of the media at one time. But then William Fulbright had the temerity to speak out about the Jewish lobby. And the Jewish lobby existed back in the 70s, just as it exists today. And he got on Face the Nation, and he said it in very simple and stark terms. He said, "Israel controls the United States Senate." William J. Fulbright. Well, after that, no matter what his liberal credentials, which the media tends to like, no matter what his liberal credentials, he was attacked viciously, and tremendous amounts of Jewish money went in and support Dale Bumpers in Arkansas, and other Jewish money and influence, of course, in media went against him, and they just called in their chips, their connections, and eventually they defeated him. Another perfect example of that kind of pressure and power is the campaign of Charles Percy in Illinois, who was a very powerful senator from a very powerful state, a Democrat senator and Democrat state. And he absolutely was popular, but he began to take a position that didn't please the Israel lobby, and they went to work against him. Representative Paul Finley, I could give a tremendous number of examples of that. Another organization is the Council of Jewish Presidents, in addition to AIPAC. A very powerful organization representing about 56 of the largest organizations, and I've got another article on that organization talking about how it's extremely radical and extremely pro-Likud and so forth. So these aren't all Jews, but that's the 63 largest Jewish groups. You have the American Jewish Committee, the most powerful Jewish organization. You have AIPAC. And so you do have a tremendous amount of organized Jewish power that certainly flexes its muscle and supports Israel, and I believe it supports Israel above the interests of the United States of America, and puts our boys in danger, and not just Israel itself, but Israel's agenda, such as the Iraq War, which was really part of Israel's agenda. It was all about Israel's agenda of securing their, what they call their realm in the Middle East. And that was the paper, of course, that Richard Perle and David Wormser and Douglas Feith wrote for Benjamin Netanyahu. And here's this man who serves the American government, writes a paper for Israel, And this is previous to the Iraq War, talking about we need a war with Iraq and Syria, by the way, and Iran, which we seem to be getting ever closer to each day. Oil is soaring again, around $70 a barrel, as the saber rattling continues. And if we go to war against Iran, ladies and gentlemen, it'll be a terribly tragic thing. So the question is, is what about the remaining non-supremacist Jews? You know, are they allowing, or will they certainly support, you know, white nationalism? And my answer to that is, I think overwhelmingly no. I think there are some individuals and some exceptions, no doubt. And I think that you have to understand something, that even though the average Jew may not be active in these particular areas, he might not be giving money to any candidate, he might not have any position much on the Iraq war, but they tend to, they're very close-knit and very supportive group of people, and they tend to support Jewish organizations that do these kind of things. They're the support mechanism for these groups, and their leaders do. So even if it's an individual Jew who is not that animated about for the war in Iraq or for Israel, so many of them support, and with huge amounts of money, organizations that do act in this behalf. Look at the tremendous budget of the ADL, for instance, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. Very, very powerful organization. They can smear anybody who dares to stand up, you know, for America First, who dares to stand up against this powerful Jewish lobby. So, ladies and gentlemen, there is a difference. You know, I certainly, when I deal with people individually, I deal with people individually, but I also recognize the reality of Jewish power. I recognize the reality of the group. It's kind of like when a nation gets at war with another nation. You know, we may go to war against, you know, Iraq, and there may be, in the process of this war, there may be individuals in there who are not opposed to us, but the group, you know, is an enemy. At least that's what our government created in that war. But it's the same kind of situation, ladies and gentlemen. It's we have a group problem. We're not all simply individuals. There is a reality of individuals in the world, and there is a reality of groups. And this principle, this reality applies not just to the Jewish question and the Israeli lobby question. It applies to the race issue. It applies to religion, many other aspects of life. If you can't deal with the reality of groups, you know, you can't deal with the reality of individuals. I mean, you can talk about how you want to live as an individual, but you live in and among a group. And if a society is composed of a particular group and you're not of that group, it's going to affect you and the way you live in so many ways. We have massive Mexican immigration coming into the United States. It's really nothing less than a massive invasion of the United States of America. And this invasion, by the way, has been fomented and promoted by the Jewish organized groups again. In fact, I have some good articles on my website dealing with that issue. But if America, if you're in the Southwest, or for that matter, if you're in North Carolina and you're in a county, and that county was traditionally European American, and your kids went to European American schools that spoke English and European American values and culture and all the rest of it, but massive immigration came in, massive settlement, and soon your town was overloaded and you became, or your community became, mostly Mexican. You know the conditions. You realize, I think, those of you listening know how the conditions and the environment of that town would change. You know, I can guarantee you, you'd have more trouble with some violence. I can guarantee you, you'd have trouble in terms of, you know, how are the teachers going to teach in school? Are they going to teach in Mexican, where the Mexicans can't understand and where they suffer? Are they going to teach in English? And I can tell you, after the classes become mostly Mexican, the American children are not going to get the education that they need. In fact, the teachers either are going to slow up in English and slow down the educational level of the European American children, or are they going to have to leave the Mexican American children behind. These are the kinds of choices and changes that are going to happen. America, if it becomes mostly Mexican, I promise you will eventually someday resemble that of Mexico. And there's some great parts of Mexico. I've been to Guadalajara, I've been to Mexico City, I've been to Puerto Vallarta, and Acapulco, a number of other places in Mexico. I've been to Yucatan Peninsula. And there's some great places in Mexico. I love it. But there's also, you know, a great deal, 90% of Mexico that's dirt poor, where many people live with dirt floors. A tremendous number of people don't even have running water, or they have outhouses where they use the restroom, the facilities. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, it's just not the way that I want my children to live and my society to be. The politics are extremely corrupt, and I know our politics are corrupt too, and that's one reason why I'm against AIPAC. But ladies and gentlemen, this is the future. We there are things such as groups. And there are group norms, and there are group realities, and group, there's a group truth. And there is, in this country, a group called the Jewish people. And as a group, they make a big impact on America. That doesn't mean every Jew acts negatively, that every Jew acts for Israel over America. But it certainly means that a lot of them do. A lot of the organized, powerful groups do. And we've had a lot of other issues, of course, from some of the Jewish people. Not all Jews, but look at the domination, for instance, of the pornographic rackets. It's become mainstream in America. I've got an article on my website talking about how they basically were the bearers, the flag bearers of the pornographic movement in the United States and the change of our mores and values. They become controlling of the media, and I don't think the media gives the values and the principles of this country. I tell you one thing, if I wore cowboy boots, I don't, you know, I have in my life. I've lived in Texas for a little while before, a couple times in my life. One time when I was very young, with my sister and her husband for just a summer. Another time, of course, more recently in Big Spring. And I've worn cowboy boots and a cowboy hat before in my life, but let me tell you something. I feel really sorry for any Texan that comes to Moscow on the street and wears cowboy boots and a cowboy hat, or does that in Italy or Germany or Austria or anywhere else in the world. You know why? Because now, with the Oscar-winning movie *Brokeback Mountain*, and this value that our Hollywood has given us. Immediately people associate now cowboy boots and cowboy hat, and it's no longer the Marlboro Man anymore, ladies and gentlemen. It's the broken back man, it's just amazing, and that's the kind of changes that are going on in terms of our society and our value system. Now, has it been all Jews that have done this? No. But certainly they provided really the impetus to change our values. Sigmund Freud was a tremendous influencer of the sexual more revolution that existed in Europe and America. We can go further. We can talk about many different aspects of our society. I've got a video that I just downloaded recently. And it's from Israel, and it's actually by some courageous media people in Israel that talk about the incredible white slave trade that goes on in Russia. And I saw this media video, and it almost brought tears to my eyes. You see these blonde Russian girls. They talk about the fact that most of these are Russian girls, and how that they are imprisoned and enslaved and treated absolutely degraded in every way. Some of them are forced to have sex with 27 men or more, 30 men a day. And many of these are abused, and you can imagine the nastiness, the filth that they must deal with. and they're absolutely held like slaves, and they're put on a trading block like slaves. And the government, really, they've done a little bit about it, but they've done really nothing about it. And this whole slave trade, not just to Israel, Israel's a small, that's the tip of the iceberg, because it really is primarily a Jewish trade. And again, I document that in Jewish supremacism. So there are individual Jews that I respect, and I really respect those Jews who are trying to clean up the act in the Jewish community, who are trying to stop these negative aspects, who say if Jews are going to live as a minority in other countries of the world, that they're going to live according to the mores and the values of the people. They're not going to try to change the mores and get involved in all these negative behaviors and certainly twist the American foreign policy to that of a foreign nation. They're going to be patriotic. And so they speak out, and sometimes it comes at a great cost to them. And I admire them, and I respect them greatly. And I respect Jews in Israel greatly who have tried to fight against the values of Jewish supremacism. But I cannot turn my eyes away and turn my mind from the recognition of the fact that there is a group problem and that we have to deal with the group problem and recognize it. And we have to begin to create an American system, I think, in our own country, where we create our own media, our own movies, our own values, our own society, our own foreign policy, and that we don't let a small group who has alien intentions from controlling that policy. You know, what's happening is it's not our people are turned away. Our people basically are frozen out in so many different ways. And I guess what I'm saying is that they may be frozen out eventually. But that's just the way it is. I mean, either they are or we are. We have been in our own country. And I'll just close with one last thing. I read a New York Times article today about how people are doing DNA testing. And by the way, I'm very suspicious about the DNA testing about your heritage. They use certain gene frequencies, which are not necessarily that accurate in some ways. But anyway, they talk about people that have partially black blood or partially non-white blood. And people are using this to get government money, tax-free money, and entrance into some of the leading universities just by showing they have black blood. Now, that to me reveals the absolute insanity of affirmative action, the incredible insanity of it. Because these are many people from, you know, who are adopted people finding out that they're of part black ancestry or part non-white ancestry, adopted upper middle class, sometimes upper class families. So they do a DNA test, they find out they got some black blood, and now suddenly they're entitled to your tax money and my tax money. And they're entitled to be placed ahead of a fully white child who has worked harder and got better grades and got better scores for qualification for the medical school or for the university or for the graduate school or for whatever. I mean, it's insane, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? It's absolutely insane. How in the world does somebody who finds out, is raised in an upper middle class family, and he finds out, he shows through DNA he's partially black, how in the world does he deserve to be put ahead? He scores less, but be put ahead of, say, a poor white child, born in a trailer park, raised by a single alcoholic parent, you know what I mean, but who struggled and fought every bit of his life and to excel and to study and to work and be responsible and be self-disciplined. And now he applies for the university, he scores higher in the test, he's got better grades in school, but he finds himself denied because somebody's got some black genes in their background, supposedly. It's insane. But that's what affirmative action is. It doesn't give you a basis of this discrimination on the basis of your abilities. It doesn't give it even on the basis of your income. It's based purely on your race. And blacks who come from a middle-class family or have two parents that are college professors, for that matter, will be given favored treatment over a better qualified white individual who comes from two parents who don't even have a high school education. You know, so we have a very terribly biased system, and I believe that I'm acting for true civil rights and true human rights when I oppose affirmative action. That affirmative action itself is a viciously racist program, a racist program against better qualified white people, and certainly against, in many cases, people who have worked very much harder and sometimes even overcome more obstacles than the people who are, in fact, favored. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I enjoyed being with you again today. We've had a lot of interesting conversation, and I do look forward very much to being with you again tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm going to take a number of questions, so be prepared tomorrow. We're a little bit out of time today, but thanks so much for your great support. I need your support to continue. You know, my address is on davidduke.com. We need your help, and Stormfront certainly does as well. We've got to continue to work, educate more and more people. This latest paper from Harvard is showing that my work and my ideas are really being validated by the leading university in our country, and I think that's going to continue as we go along. Well, again, thank you so much, and I'll certainly see you again tomorrow.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.davidduke.com.